This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Das ist Ihre Millionenchance. Jetzt im Lotto-Jackpot. 19 Millionen Euro. 19 Millionen Euro.
Lotto Bayern. Nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Chance auf den Höchstgewinn 1 zu 140 Millionen. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bjuk.de.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this week's programme, after North Korea's latest missile test, we'll examine the technology behind ballistic missiles and ask how much of a threat they represent. On Tuesday morning, local time, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea lobbed a missile over Japan and into the sea beyond. A few weeks ago, the Briefing Room briefed you on the people who fired the missile. This week, we're looking at the missile. What have the North Koreans got and what are they developing? What damage could they do and to who? And is there any way of intercepting it? Step into the Briefing Room and find out. Long-range missile attack was supposed to be a threat from the past. Older listeners may, like me, remember this from 34 years ago.
What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies? I know this is a formidable technical task, one that may not be accomplished before the end of this century. Yet current technology has attained a level of sophistication where it's reasonable for us to begin this effort.
That was President Reagan announcing the Strategic Defense Initiative, which would come to be known as Star Wars. So what happened to that and the various other expensive systems designed to remove the missile threat? For many years, Dr. Patricia Lewis worked for the United Nations on the problem of the proliferation of nuclear and chemical weapons. She now works on international security for Chatham House, the foreign affairs think tank. She came into the Briefing Room earlier and began by explaining how intercontinental ballistic missiles work.
The kind of technology that goes into making them is exactly the same technology as the technology we have for putting satellites up into orbit or putting people on the moon or going to Mars. It's rocket engines, it's exactly the same shape. It's just that the thing that it carries is an explosive rather than a person into the space station. The thing about ballistic missiles is they're not very accurate. So when you throw a ball up in the air and have it come back down again, you can see that that would be highly inaccurate. Now, you can make them more accurate with guidance systems, but they are notoriously bad at hitting their target. So if you have a conventional warhead on an intercontinental ballistic missile, chances are when it explodes, it won't be right on target. And if it's way off target, and outside the city, for example, that you're targeting, or outside the missile base that you're targeting, then exploding with a conventional weapon won't do you much good. So that's why most intercontinental ballistic missiles have nuclear warheads on them. If you miss with a nuclear warhead, it will still do an enormous amount of damage wherever it is. And so the accuracy isn't such a big problem. The design of these missiles is quite variable. So you could have a single warhead on top of a missile, or you could have multiple warheads on top of a missile. And when you have multiple warheads on top of missiles, you can also target them independently. I'm not sure that North Korea has that type of technology as yet. In fact, I'm sure it hasn't. So what we'd be looking at with North Korea is probably a single warhead on top of a ballistic missile. So nuclear warheads are in a class of their own when it comes to damage. The amount of energy that's released, it's millions of times more than any conventional explosive. So the damage is, first of all, in the enormous amount of heat and blast, and that's about 80 to 85% of the energy contained. Just to give you a comparison, if you had the size of the Hiroshima bomb, which is actually a fairly common size in terms of the type of warhead that are on these missiles. And if you look at a single city, you could be talking of tens of millions of people killed. And if you look at attacks on several cities, you could be looking at hundreds of millions of people being killed. We don't really know for sure what capacity North Korea has on the nuclear warhead side. They have been developing nuclear warheads and they've carried out nuclear weapons tests 5 times. So far, they've been carrying out large numbers of ballistic missile tests, their flight tests. And we know that they've developed a long range, nearly intercontinental range ballistic missile. But whether or not that ballistic missile could be equipped with a nuclear warhead, we don't know. And whether or not it's been tested with the weight of a nuclear warhead and therefore with the same range, it could find the same range with a nuclear warhead, we don't know that either. So there are a lot of unknowns at the moment. There are people trying to work it out from the trajectories. There are people trying to work it out from piecing together bits of information. And as you know, the United States intelligence agencies recently came out with a statement that it's their belief that North Korea has crossed the threshold and actually has developed a warhead that can sit on top of a nuclear missile. And I think most experts and analysts would say that they don't know, but it would be prudent to assume that that's the case at the moment. So it's taken them decades to get this far, but in the last couple of years, they've got much further, much more quickly than they have before. And I think that has shocked people in the speed at which they've been able to develop in the last few years.
Dr. Patricia Lewis. Joining me now to look at the reality of the threat of these missiles and whether realistic means do or can exist to stop them are Sir Lawrence Freedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. From Boston in the US, Laura Grego, a nuclear scientist who works for the Union of Concerned Scientists, an organisation which campaigns for a safer world. And from Cape Cod in the US, Joseph Cirincione, who is president of the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation and author of several books on nuclear weapons. Joe Cirincione, can I start with you and ask you to take me through the history of ICBM missiles? When did they first appear?
Well, we first were introduced to ballistic missiles at the end of World War II when the Nazis developed the B-2 rocket missile to launch against London. They were actually working on a longer-range weapon that could hit New York, but they didn't get a chance to finish it before they were defeated. Both the Soviets and the U.S. took some of these Nazi scientists back to their countries and put them to work on their missile programs. Both the U.S. and the Soviet Union tested intercontinental ballistic missiles, that is, missiles that could fly more than 5,500 kilometers, could span the oceans, in 1957. And then both had deployed these missiles by 1959, within about a month of each other. Over the decade, these forces grew both in numbers and in quality, in payload, in length of travel, how far they could go. There are now approximately 5 countries that have this capability, including the U.S., Russia, China, the U.K., and France. There's a few others, such as India and Pakistan and Israel, that could develop this but have not. And finally, North Korea, just in the last month, has now tested a true intercontinental ballistic missile that is something that could fly over 5,500, 6,000 kilometers, becoming only the 6th, 7th member of this club.
That puts its significance into some kind of context. What exactly does the United Kingdom have in by way of intercontinental ballistic missiles? I'm sorry to sound parochial.
Sure. Traditionally, people count ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, as land-based. So the U.S. has them in silos, so Russia has them in silos, land-based configurations. So does China. The United Kingdom has long-range missiles on its submarines. There's 4 submarines that the United Kingdom has. Each of them carries 16 missiles, And those missiles are what's called the D-5 Trident II missile. And these missiles can go over 6,000, depending on the configuration, perhaps 8,000 kilometers. And with those submarines, the United Kingdom can reach almost any spot on Earth if it so desired.
Laura Grego, we're going to discuss in detail missile defence system and whether they're effective in a moment. But first, I just want to ask you, can you take us through the history and development of missile defence?
Yes, well, as soon as there were intercontinental ballistic missiles, states were concerned enough to want to be able to counter that fearsome capability. So there were various programs to try to defend against incoming nuclear-armed warheads. And some of those programs considered using nuclear weapons to actually destroy the incoming weapons. But if we start the story in the early 80s, when President Ronald Reagan announced his Strategic Defense Initiative, which has become nicknamed Star Wars, that was a grand, wildly complicated, wildly expensive idea to provide an impenetrable shield against incoming missiles. And that included space-based and ground-based, lots of different components. There was enormous technical and financial challenges to do something like that. And eventually that program was shrunk and abandoned, but the ideas eventually came back down to the ground. And that's where we are today. So technology that was developed during the Clinton administration were taken up in earnest by the George W. Bush administration. And when that administration came into power, it withdrew the United States from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which had limited these systems for 30 years. But the George W. Bush administration decided to get something in the ground really quickly and said, in a couple of years, we want to see a system stood up. And that system is called the Ground-Based Mid-Course Defense System. And that's the primary or only U.S. system that is meant to counter intercontinental ballistic missiles. So the way that system is meant to work is as an attacking missile is launched, let's say, nominally from North Korea, the space-based infrared sensors, so sensors on satellites, will see that very bright launch. So an ICBM looks a lot like if you've ever seen a space launch video or if you've ever been lucky enough to see them, huge bright events. So those are easily detected. And so that starts to cue radars, and the radars see this big rocket lifting up and starts to figure out where it's headed. And then the whole system starts to work. The sensors line up, and they cue these enormous interceptors, which also look like big space launch vehicles. And most of those in the U.S. are situated in Alaska. There's a few in California, but most of them are in Alaska. And they will launch at high speeds something to go and basically meet up in space and try to destroy an incoming warhead. So you get two really fast-moving things, and you're trying to get them to collide. So they're going 7 kilometers a second or something like that, or 25,000 kilometers an hour, so really fast. So you'll often hear it described as hitting a bullet with a bullet. And also, these missile defenses that I've described are all maybe not infancy, but they are not mature systems. They haven't, you know, some of them are tested better than others, but you know, the GMD system, the ground-based mid-course, has had a very checkered history. Some of the shorter-range systems have been tested for longer and have a better development history, but we're building these things hoping to never use them, hoping to never have to do that.
So, in other words,
that's the strategy, is to make sure, spend the bulk of your time and resources to make sure you never face those threats rather than trying to get them when everything else fails.
Lawrence Freeburn, if I could bring you in at that point, it seems from that as if actually, even if you had the capacity to shoot these things down, then in that case it would be a very kind of uncertain business. But I do recall from some of our earlier encounters, you and I, when I was much younger and you were much younger too, when we were making programmes about this sort of thing, that there was a big discussion about whether or not the installation of systems to try and shoot down missiles weren't themselves provocative and creative of difficulty. Now, that may not seem obvious to the listener. Could you take us through the problem there?
Yes. If you go right back to the 1950s, when intercontinental ballistic missiles were first being developed, it seemed the most natural thing to try to defend against them. At the same time, there was concern about what would happen if somebody managed to use their missiles not to attack cities, centres of population, so much as the missiles of the other side. That was called a first strike. You would then effectively disarm your opponent, have them at your mercy. When you extended that thought, if, say, some missiles escaped the first strike, maybe then you could take them down with ballistic missile defences much easier than having to take down a whole arsenal being shot at you. So in that way, people started to see ballistic missile defences as being an extension of a first strike capability. And the judgment made in the mid-60s, essentially to get out of the expense of building ballistic missile defences, was to demonstrate that first that they were actually futile, that they could always be overwhelmed with enough offensive systems, but also that this would be destabilising. And that's where the idea of mutual assured destruction comes from. Destruction would be assured. So from that point on, the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty limited very dramatically the ability of both sides to deploy these systems on the assumption that that confirmed deterrence, that there was no way out of it. Later on, this was seen to be almost unethical, that you were missing opportunities to defend your population. In the Star Wars period, Reagan talked about better to protect than avenge. I think also now, when you're talking most of the time in terms of missile threats, not about intercontinental nucleus, but about short-range conventional, then that ethical issue doesn't seem so strong. Indeed, it seems a bit baffling. But in terms of the logic of strategic deterrence, it's still there, which is why China objects to potential anti-missile systems in South Korea, why Russia has objected to NATO having these systems as well.
So essentially, if somebody has a missile defence system and the other side doesn't, then the side that doesn't can worry that the side that does could actually use nuclear weapons against them.
Potentially, it makes it easier. If you believe that they were reliable and things were going to work as you were told they were going to work on the actual day.
So then that comes down to the next question, which is, how reliable are they? We've already heard from Laura Gregor that they may not be particularly reliable. So do you also play some strange game of bluff in which you kind of suggest that you have ones that are reliable when they're not?
I think with these largely untested ones dealing with intercontinental missiles, there's inevitably a game of bluff, but also just of sheer practicality. If you're trying to deal with a missile threat from the United States or from Russia, there's probably a limited amount you can do with it, even if your systems are working very well, because you've got so much of an area to defend. And just a few getting through produces complete catastrophe. But when we're talking about shorter range threats, and we have to keep in mind that for most countries, most of the time, that's the problem, then, yeah, we know that they can do some good, that they can limit the amount of damage you get. But it's very different when you're talking with a few conventional missiles landing, which will do some damage, than just one nuclear missile landing, which will obliterate everything around it.
Good point. So let's look at what's been happening this week. One of the things that's bound to be said is we seem to be very exercised by the possibility of the North Koreans having the capacity to hit the United States with nuclear weapons, and yet we seem to be infinitely more relaxed about their capacity to hit Japan, Joe Cirincione.
The Japanese and the North Koreans have been living with the North Korean nuclear threat for some time now. North Korea has short-range missiles, Nodongs, that they can fit almost certainly with a small nuclear warhead that could hit any target they wanted in South Korea or Japan. So it's a little disturbing to see the U.S. get so exercised now that North Korea might be developing the capability. Most of us think that if they just keep at it, they will have the capability to hit the United States with a nuclear warhead. But the fear is that this will deter the United States, that once the United States cities are at risk, will the United States actually risk Seattle for Seoul? Will they come to South Korea's defense? I think the answer to that is obvious. Of course we will. Of course it will happen. And the idea that there's some sort of magic shield that you can create that could prevent that from happening is a complete fantasy. Ever since the B-2s, people have been looking for a reliable way to stop ballistic missiles. It's not for lack of effort. It's not for lack of scientific understanding. The best people, hundreds of billions of dollars. The United States alone has spent over $300 billion trying to develop an effective missile defense system. It has failed. And the reason is as basic as castles and catapults. ever since the beginning of warfare, the offense has had an advantage. It is far cheaper for the offense to develop methods that can overcome your defense, even when you get to the point where you can hit a bullet with a bullet, which is remarkable that we can do this, is you have to see the bullet. And it's very easy for a determined foe, the Chinese do this, the Russians do this, we do this, to configure their warheads and their ballistic missiles so that the enemy can't see them using decoys or jammers or simple techniques like just tumbling the warhead in space. So it's very, very difficult to actually see the warhead and then hit it, which means that you're never going to have a reliable defensive system. And any strategy that is based on that is doomed to fail. And that's why when you get to North Korea, there is no, this is why you keep hearing people say this, there is no military solution to North Korea. There is no first strike that could knock out North Korea that would prevent them from striking us, nor is there any combination of a shield, a missile shield that could prevent the North Korean threat. If you don't want North Korea to hit you with a missile, whether you're in Seoul or Tokyo or Washington, D.C., there's only one solution, and that's negotiate a solution, negotiate a security agreement with North Korea.
I want to come to a little bit more on that in a moment, Joe, but Laura Grego, can I just try with you one last attempt to conjure up a defence system, which is the idea that, OK, we might not be able to hit these missiles once they're in mid-air with something else, but given our incredible cyber capacities and the development of technology, we might be able to mess with them, their systems, etc., before these things are launched or just after launches and so on. Does that seem at all likely?
I actually don't think so. I mean, you do hear rumours that there's been an attempt to do that, and I would expect that that probably has been tried. But I think that at best would be a temporary setback. They're not going to save your bacon.
Lawrence Freeman, could the North Koreans be sure that we didn't have the capacity to develop such systems? In other words, would it be possible to suggest to them that we had in fact developed the capacity to do it in order to make them feel that this was a redundant form of threat?
Well, you can go through these sort of bluffs and counter-bluffs. And I think, you know, one tends to underestimate the awe in which, in the past anyway, US technological capacity has been held. And there are these stories about cyber attacks. So it's one of these things where anybody approaching an encounter like this would be aware of enormous uncertainties. And that's what you've got to hope for. You really want people not to have confidence about anything as you move into these sort of...
Well, doesn't that make Donald Trump the ideal president?
Well, he's not consistent in
his inconsistency.
His inconsistency. So if you're going to play these games, you've got to know what you're talking about as well. But can I make another point about no military solution, which is true. But I don't think one should assume from that there's therefore a diplomatic solution to this either, because for North Korea, this is the only thing it's got going for it. It hasn't got anything else to commend it, to make it interesting, to make it serious, other than the fact that it could batter Seoul with conventional artillery, which we shouldn't forget.
Seoul, the capital of South Korea.
Seoul, the capital of South Korea. So, and this has been the problem since the mid-90s, is that what it really wants is sort of recognition of its independent capabilities and its significance. It's used it for extortion, but it's not interested in getting rid of its nuclear capability. I can't imagine circumstances. So, like we had during the Cold War, it's something that has to be managed, I suspect, rather than solved.
OK, Laura Grego, we've heard Joe Cincione and we've heard Lawrence Freeman also there begin to talk about the next stages. Can we just step back a moment from the big questions of negotiation or not? And just, do you believe that the North Koreans will actually enhance their capacity inevitably from beyond what it is now? I mean, what would we expect the next stage to be?
Well, they seem very determined, and they, I think, have surprised a number of people, or maybe those who hadn't closely watched, with how determined they are and what kind of progress they're making. And, you know, we saw recently a missile that could reach ICBM distances. Now, we don't know what payload it could carry, payload meaning how much mass. So it's important to note, not only do you need to get a missile to go a far distance, but for it to be a military capability, you need it to be able to carry something heavy enough to be a nuclear weapon. So there's that other branch of technology they need to master, which is building a nuclear weapon that's small enough to be carried and mounted to a missile. So those are technologies that one needs to master to build this capability, but these are also known for decades. So there's a roadmap there for them to follow. So, I mean, the question is not will they ever, it's when that would happen and how are we going to manage it.
Joe Cimentione, can the United States live with a nuclear-armed North Korea that could target a missile onto the continental United States itself? Can it actually live with a North Korea that can do that?
My quick answer is yes, and we may have to. And the reason I say we can live with them is because we have lived with similar threats. When the Soviet Union got long-range ballistic missiles that could drop nuclear weapons on our cities, it was a similar concern about the stability, the rationality of the Soviets. Could you live? Yes. Deterrence is alive and well. Even though North Korea could have the capability, and I believe if they continue with their current program, they will have that capability in the next 2 to 4 years to hit the United States with a nuclear-armed missile. Even if they have it, doesn't mean they will use it. Because as vicious, as ruthless as the ruler of North Korea is, Kim Jong-un, he's not suicidal. Why is he doing this? What is the purpose of his program? I believe he's doing this for the same reason every other country has developed nuclear weapons, security and prestige. Not a bolt out of the blue attack, not to go down in the glory of nuclear flames, but to protect his regime, which protect him. So he wants to have this capability as a deterrent to stop the United States from attacking him. And in turn, we have to have sufficient military capability to ensure that if he ever does this, if they ever were to strike first against the United States, that it would be the last act of his regime. That's how you live with a nuclear-armed North Korea. You don't like it, but you could live with a nuclear-armed North Korea.
Lawrence Friedman, is that what we're going to have to do?
Yes, I think it's very hard at the moment to see an alternative. We have to keep in mind that North Korea is not only a particularly nasty regime, but also pretty poor, and the threats may be internal as well as external, and that all of this is a continuation of a war which was never actually concluded, the Korean War of the early 50s, which only ended with a ceasefire. There's still a ceasefire line. And the actual battle is between North and South Korea. And there's always that possibility of tensions developing between the two. And this war wouldn't necessarily start if it started with missile strikes. It would start probably with encounters along the demilitarized zone, possibly with conventional artillery barrages and so on, before we got onto this. So, yes, we can live with it, may have to live with it, but it doesn't mean alter the fact that it's still quite a very dangerous situation.
So what I gather from this is there's no likely military solution and indeed probably not even a diplomatic solution which will get North Korea to abandon its programme. And by and large, the approach that we've got to take is that we're going to have to somehow live with it and manage the danger. My thanks to Dr. Patricia Lewis, Joseph Cimentione, Sir Lawrence Friedman and Laura Greger. We'll be back at the same time next week, nuclear weapons permitting. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Jim Frank, China Collins and Serena Tarling. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4. History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to history's toughest heroes, wherever you get your podcast.